This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy is the Senate's most senior member, first elected in 1974 as one of the so-called Watergate babies to clean up national politics and bring the country together. He has now decided it's time to retire, and Senator Leahy has written a new memoir recounting his long career in American politics. It's called The Road Taken. Senator Leahy joins us now from Washington, D.C. Senator, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you, Kimberly. I'm delighted to have the opportunity.
So let's talk about this arc of your career. You began, as I said, in the Senate post-Watergate, and you're preparing to retire as the Capitol and the nation still reels from the insurrection of last year. How different are things now than when you started?
Oh, the arc is so significant that in fact, that's one of the reasons I started writing the book. I've taken notes almost every day from the time I first came there as an awestruck 34-year-old. And when, as I was wrapping up the writing of the book, January 6th hit us and the insurrection at the Capitol, I'd never seen anything like that. I never thought anything like that would be possible. And it just it shook me to the core. It shook a whole lot of people to the core. And I don't think I'll ever forget that time. But I also think about what it means to people who actually supported that insurrection. What does that mean to the direction our country is going?
Yeah. So how different, you mentioned that you first were a freshman senator in back when you were 34 years old. How is 34-year-old Senator Leahy different from the Senator Leahy of today?
Well, in some ways, I wrote the book for 34-year-olds who might be coming in so they could see the arc of history that we had during that time. You know, I was an awestruck young man. I'd been a prosecutor for 8 years. I came from a state, the only state in the Union that never elected a Democrat to the U.S. Senate, and certainly never elected anybody under 50 since the popular election of senators. And I do recall one of the very senior senators saying to me, "How old are you, boy?" And I said, "Well, I'm 34. He said, "Anybody ever tell you you're too young to be in the United States Senate?" I said, "Yeah, my opponent, for one." He actually liked that and thought, "Well, okay, I could probably pass the test." But I also walked in there and saw the people who had made history. Remember, this was shortly after Richard Nixon had resigned. Mm-hmm. I saw two of the pillars of the Republican Party: Hugh Scott, the Republican leader; Barry Goldwater, Mr. Conservative. They had the unenviable task of going down to the White House and telling President Nixon he had to leave or he was going to be impeached. They took no pleasure in that. And I got to know both of them quite well and talked to them about it. They said it was one of the most difficult things they did. They're both ardent Republicans. They strongly supported having a Republican as president, but they knew the country came first, and they had to set aside their politics. They had to set aside their own personal feelings, and they had to tell a president who had broken the law, it's time to go.
Mm-hmm. So how has that changed in your time in the Senate, where you yourself have seen a number of impeachment hearings, both for President Clinton and two for President Trump? How do you think that process has changed? Do you think there will ever be, like in 1974, a situation where members of a president's own party would go to him and say, "This is over, you need to step down"?
Well, I would hope that we would not face a time when a president would be in that position. I felt that after I came to the Senate, and then I saw during the end of his term, Donald Trump saying, I'm not leaving. I don't accept the results of the election. Joe Biden got 4 or 5 million more votes than Donald Trump, but he wasn't going to accept that. He said that he really was the one who won all these votes. And, you know, I think of Al Gore, who I'm sure felt that he had gotten more votes than George W. Bush, but after the Supreme Court ruling, he accepted it, conceded the election, and then had the unenviable chore as vice president to have to certify his opponent as being the new president. What a difference in watching what Donald Trump was doing. Although during that time, I mean, everything just came cascading on January 6th. Can you imagine? We have certain rules of decorum in the Senate. We'd seen some of the senators posturing, and that really posturing, trying to do sound bites for the cameras about why they supported Donald Trump. But then all of a sudden we're in the Senate chamber, armed officers are coming in, rushing the vice president out. I looked beside, in the aisle beside me. Here's a battle-clad police officer carrying a machine gun. You never have anybody with weapons coming on the Senate floor. And they're saying, we have to get you all out of here right now. And we go down a small stairway in the back of the Senate chamber, and we end up going to another building, to a secure area. Heavily armed officers and military around there. And it's something out of a fiction, out of a bad television movie to see this, but it was real. We then turned on the TV screens and we could see the people smashing doors, going through the Capitol, assaulting police officers. Because of my seniority, I have an office in the Capitol. It's just a door away from where the Speaker's Capitol office is, and I could see people with hammers and other things going down that hall, smashing in doors. It was a frightening scene.
Do you think that the Senate, Congress in general, can recover from that moment? I mean, to this day, you still have members who cast doubt on the result of the 2020 election. You saw in the aftermath of this, while some Republican members in particular condemned in the immediate aftermath, they've sort of pulled back that condemnation since. Do you think that that partisanship, at its most extreme form, will ever release its hold on the Congress?
If it does not release its hold, then the whole country suffers. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, the country suffers if we have this happen. I'll tell you a short story. We were in the room, the secure room. Somebody pointed out that as the Senate, we were all there, we could have voted to have the Senate meet there. I stood up and said, look, I'm the dean of the Senate. I'm totally opposed to that. I don't want to meet here in a hidden room. Let's wait till it's safe to go back into the Senate chamber and meet where the American public can see us doing our job. I was surprised to have almost a standing ovation from everybody, Republican, Democrat, saying they agreed. Let's go back and show who we are. And a couple of the senators who originally were going to oppose the certification of the ballots said they weren't going to oppose anymore. It was time for us to come together. So for that short period, while we are still, you know, walking over broken glass and seeing what's going on, there was a coming together. Unfortunately, it hasn't lasted long enough. I applaud Mike Pence for not leaving the Capitol, even though they told him he should. He stayed there because he felt his duties as vice president and president of the U.S. Senate required him to stay there, even though he knew that he's going to be ending up certifying that he and Donald Trump had lost the re-election.
Yeah. So one thing, reading this book, and as you're talking about your life, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that you basically write it as a joint journey with your wife, Marcel. Why was that so important to you?
Well, every decision we've made in life, we've made together. We got married when I was a law student at Georgetown. She had recently graduated from nurse training, got her RN, was going to work at a VA hospital near where our apartment was. And we didn't have any money. We were living in a basement apartment. We didn't have a car, but I could walk to work with her. She had a night on the night shift. And everything, we traveled this together. We decided to go back to Vermont to practice law. Yeah. We're raising a family. And we made the decision together that I'd run for the Senate, even knowing that it'd be nearly impossible for me to win.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to pause you right there, and we'll talk more about it after our break. I'm speaking with Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy and his half-century-long political career as it comes to the close. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. My guest today is Vermont Senator Democrat Patrick Leahy. As his eighth term as senator draws to a close, he's out with a new memoir today called The Road Taken. We have an excerpt from it on our website, onpointradio.org. Senator, you were talking about winning that Senate seat against all odds with your wife. I want to let you finish that.
No, it's just that 5 days before the election, in our state's politically most influential newspaper, they had on the front page in huge type, "Poll dooms Leahy." That was kind of a tense weekend. And then 5 days later, the headline, same size type, same place on the front page, "Leahy unexpectedly wins Senate seat." And it was unexpected because we'd never elected a Democrat, never elected anybody my age. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, you know, I may be here, I may be in the Senate only one term, but I should do what I feel is best. Shortly after I got in the Senate, the committee I was on was going to have a vote to reauthorize and continue the war in Vietnam. Nobody from Vermont in the Congress ever voted against the war in Vietnam. They expressed concerns about it, but always voted to continue it. Even though our state's largest newspaper strongly supported the war, I voted against it. And we had five votes in a row, each one by a one-vote margin, the vote to end the war prevailed. I've always been proud of that vote. I mean, the war would have ended at some point anyway, but I felt strongly that whether it cost me the next re-election or not, this was a vote of, to me, it was a essential vote. And so I voted that way. But what I've tried to do in the, I voted more than anybody else in the Senate. I've tried to tell new senators, whatever the issue is, vote your conscience. Even if it turns out, in retrospect, maybe you should have voted differently, the issue will come up again. But vote your conscience. Now, there's too much of people taking polls. How do I vote in this? How do I vote in that? Vote your conscience.
So in the book, you write, you have many anecdotes about your time in the Senate. I was struck about you you explaining your relationship with Barry Goldwater, which you described as an odd coupling. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, my first re-election, I had the second closest election in America. And I was giving a speech somewhere in Vermont. Somebody stands up and says, "Leahy, didn't the closeness of that election teach you nothing?" And I said, "Well, I figured it must be have something to do with my political philosophy, but I couldn't figure out what the lesson was." So I called the senator who had the closest election in the country, and I said, "Barry Goldwater, what's the lesson?" Well, that got printed in the press out in Arizona. He called me up just laughing his head off. He said, "To think of the two of us have the being the two closest elections in the country, we're a million miles apart in our philosophy." He said, "I tell you what, I'm moving my office to a nicer office. You ought to move into mine. Change your luck." And I said, "Well, I don't have the seniority." He said, "Look, we Republicans have taken over the control of the Senate. You can move next week." And I have. And I've been in Senator Goldwater's office ever since, for over 40 years. But the point of it is, he and I used to sit and talk. Sometimes we'd have be Barry Goldwater, Hubert Humphrey. I mean, talk about two people, each ran for president, poles apart philosophically, teasing the heck out of each other, and then agreeing on something that they could do together to bring both conservatives and liberals together and moderates. And I learned a lot from that, and I've tried all my legislation to bring in both Republicans and Democrats and across the political spectrum, and I've been pretty successful. I passed the bill that started organic farming, which is now a $60 billion or so industry in the country, certainly to pass the Leahy War Victims Fund. I had called it the War Victims Fund, and it was a Republican, Mitch McConnell, who moved to have it named the Patrick Leahy War Victims Fund. And that's to help the victims of war, usually civilians, all over the world. And it saved and rehabilitated so many lives. I used it in, and have used it in Vietnam, been there a number of times. It's helped to solidify our relations with Vietnam, a country that we spent years engaging in war.
Yeah. So you anticipated my next question, which is to talk about some of the policy initiatives you've been involved with. Here's a campaign ad you ran in 2016 touting the expansion of the farm-to-school program you fought for 3 years earlier, called the Improving Child Nutrition Integrity and Access Act.
School lunch used to look like this, and it didn't taste much better.
So Pat cooked up a plan.
His farm-to-school program brings locally grown and produced foods to lunchrooms in Vermont and all across America, giving farmers a boost and helping kids eat healthier. And Senator Leahy's working to expand the program and double the purchasing power.
Okay, kids, let's eat.
Pat Leahy, always working for Vermont.
This is really good. I'm Pat Leahy, and I approve this tasty message.
And just a note to our audience, you heard Marcel in that ad as well. Talk about that effort.
Well, you know, I had seen what school lunches were like, and they were terrible. And it was usually processed, packaged food, and yet we had farms in Vermont, as most states do, that could produce the food, and it'd be fresh food. And I started this program, to farm-to-school program, and farm-to-family program, where they could have fresh food. For one thing, it would be more edible, more nutritious, but it also teach children the value of good food. And it caught on. It caught on nationwide. I'm concerned right now that they're thinking of cutting back on school lunch programs. If you have a hungry child, that child doesn't learn. And so this should be part of the whole education process. But it was fun to do it because Marcel and I went around to various school lunches, and the kids loved to talk with us. We learned a lot from them, the beauty of a small state. But it also improved the nutrition of millions of young people around the country, and I was proud of that.
So talk a little bit more about initiatives you've spurred or votes you've taken. What do you think is the most important vote you've taken, and is there a vote you regret?
Well, you know, I've voted 17,000 times. I'm sure I could go back through there and find votes where I'd say, what the heck was I thinking? But I tell new senators, vote your conscience, because even if you think later I should have voted the other way, the issue will probably come up again, and you can learn from that. But I know when they wanted to go to war in Iraq, I actually read the intelligence on that. I knew there were no weapons of mass destruction being stored in Iraq, and I voted against the war. I was on the losing side, but I was part of that vote. And I heard from a number of senators, well, we should vote against it, but politically that would not be a good thing to do. I feel like saying, you know, the heck with politics. This is going to be life or death for a lot of people, both Americans and Iraqis. Think about that.
Mm. So I want to talk about one aspect of your job that has gotten a lot of attention over the years, and that is your role on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which vets federal judges, including Supreme Court justices. You have been present for many of the most recent Supreme Court justices' confirmation. Broadly, talk about how the confirmation process has changed, and do you think at this point it is broken?
I think it has been broken in many ways. I think that it's become too politicized, and I think that it's hurt the court and it's hurt the Senate. I know that Republicans will say, well, what about Robert Bork? Well, the fact is, Robert Bork lost in committee, but we felt he at least deserved to have a vote by the whole Senate, and so many Republicans voted against him, he lost in the Senate. You don't see that now. You see too much of the party line votes. I've voted on every Supreme Court justice since John Paul Stevens, nominated by Gerry Ford. And I voted for a lot of Republican for the Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor being one. But I'm not going to vote for somebody who comes in there when you know they have an agenda, or if I feel they haven't been truthful in their hearing. And we've had several recently that were being rushed through. The White House wouldn't allow a clear investigation of them, the Trump White House. And we found out after they had been confirmed, there were a lot of things left out. One recent nominee had been involved in receiving, in another position in government, receiving material that had been stolen from the Senate Judiciary Committee, from the Democrats. And yet the Republicans were in the majority would not allow questions about that. I think that's a fairly important thing to know about.
I want to ask about two specific confirmations that received a lot of attention. One was back in 1991, the confirmation hearing of Clarence Thomas, at which Anita Hill testified, claiming she was harassed by him. At the time, then Senator Joe Biden was the Senate Judiciary Chair. Democrats were in charge. But there was one other witness, Angela Wright, who had been subpoenaed and was interviewed, also claiming that she was harassed during her time at the EEOC, but she was not called as a witness. In retrospect, looking back at that hearing, do you think that it was handled well? Were there things you would have done differently?
I think she should have been called. I said publicly at the time that I believed Anita Hill. I thought she made a credible witness. I thought she was telling the truth. And certainly I did not feel that the then nominee, Clarence Thomas, gave a truthful response.
During the confirmation hearings in 2018 that ultimately put Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, he faced allegations that he had sexually assaulted Christine Blasey Ford when they were both in high school. At one point, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham exploded in anger. Here he is, first speaking to Democrats on the Judiciary Committee and then to Kavanaugh.
Boy, y'all want power. God, I hope you never get it. I hope the American people can see through this sham, that you knew about it and you held it. You had no intention of protecting Dr. Ford. None. She's as much of a victim as you are. God, I hate to say it, because these have been my friends. But let me tell you, when it comes to this, you're looking for a fair process. You came to the wrong town at the wrong time, my friend.
So, Senator Leahy, Senator Graham, in the past has... Go ahead. I'll let you go ahead.
No, I was just going to say he was telling the truth. He said, you're not going to get a fair process. And we didn't. He broke the rules in rushing it through, just as he did with the next nominee. We did it without having... he did not allow the witnesses we needed. And with... Christine Ford, I believed her. I mean, she had nothing to gain by coming forward. She faced hostility online and everything else by doing it, but she felt a duty to come forth and tell the truth. I found her a very, very believable witness, and knowing how Kavanaugh had been involved with receiving material stolen from the Senate Judiciary Committee, I didn't find his denial believable.
And I think let me ask you this. Senator Graham in the past has touted the fact that he voted in favor of Democratic nominees. In the past, the Supreme Court justices were passed, if not unanimously, then very close. What do you think has changed to sort of make the process devolve to what we saw as an example in 2018?
I think one of the things that happened was when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, we had a Democratic president, Republican-controlled Senate. Merrick Garland was nominated by President Obama. Numerous Republicans had said in the past that if we nominated Merrick Garland, he'd be a perfect one for the Supreme Court. Suddenly, the Republicans in the sense that we're not going to allow a hearing because it's going to be an election in a year. Well, that's never been the rule. That's never been the process. One of Ronald Reagan's nominees was put through by a Democratic-controlled Senate almost unanimously months before Ronald Reagan was going to be leaving office. A new president was coming in. But that changed the whole thing. After that, the rules I mean, it was a shameful thing, blocking that to keep it open until they had a Republican. It was a terrible mistake, and it's gone downhill ever since.
We are talking with Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy. He's out with a new memoir as his half-century career in the Senate is drawing to a close. When we come back, we'll talk about where this troubled country might go from here. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Xinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. I've been speaking with Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy about his nearly half-century career in Washington and what he's witnessed and learned during that time. His memoir has just come out today, and it's called The Road Taken, and we have an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. So, Senator Leahy, we talked a bit earlier about January 6th, and I want to return to that topic. Here's then-Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking on January 19th, 2021, talking about the assault on the Capitol building that happened 2 weeks earlier.
The last time the Senate convened, we had just reclaimed the Capitol from violent criminals who tried to stop Congress from doing our duty. The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people. And they tried to use fear and violence to stop a specific proceeding of the first branch of the federal government, which they did not like. But we pressed on. We stood together and said an angry mob would not get veto power over the rule of law in our nation.
So, Senator, that was a moment where the most powerful Republican in Congress stood and said plainly that the former president lied and provoked that crowd. He also later would decline to vote in favor of impeachment. And now other Republicans in Congress have downplayed the events of January 6th. Can you tell us, when you speak to your Republican colleagues, is what they tell you privately different from what they express publicly?
Many of them will speak privately in a different tone. They know it was a terrible time. They would like very much to put it behind them and get on to other things. Donald Trump doesn't allow them to do that. They know that he has a lot of control over their parties back in their state, and I think they're concerned about upsetting him. Now, frankly, I said, why would you want to be in the Senate if you feel you have to hide your real feelings because you're afraid of offending one person? Why would you want a job like that? You know, there's only 100 of us for the whole country. We should be the conscience of the nation. That's not being the conscience if you do that. There are others who believe strongly that Trump is right. I don't know how they come to that conclusion. Many of them are themselves hoping to run for president. They're never going to be president, but as long as they have that thought in the back of their mind, I don't think they act with the kind of freedom a U.S. senator should.
We have seen a lot of anger in the political discourse, even rising to threats, members of Congress and others. We've most recently seen FBI agents being threatened after a search warrant was conducted at the former president's residence. How concerned are you? How different is this from what you've seen over the course of your career? And how concerned are you about that?
I'm extremely concerned. I go back and I read some of the history books at the time of deep segregation in this country and the fights and the efforts to do away with segregation, ending up with Brown versus Board of Education and others taking steps. We still fight it. We have de facto segregation in parts of the country. But if we start having a strong feeling that the laws don't count, the norms of doing government doesn't count, there anybody can make up their own mind what the Constitution is, what the government is, what the law should be, then this country, the most powerful, wealthiest country in the world, is going to face its own downfall. And nobody wants, I would hope that nobody wants that. It's not a complete exaggeration to go back to the time of the Confederacy when states felt they had to break away. We hear people talking about that even today. That's not what the United States of America should be. In my state of Vermont, we have a Democratic-controlled legislature. We have a Republican governor, and they work together. And I do the same thing with our Republican governor. I talk to him quite often about legislation that's coming up that affect Vermont. How can we make it better? What can we do? That's what should be done. Certainly, we'll disagree on some things, but should at least agree that laws should be followed, the Constitution should be followed. And just because you don't like something that's happened, you don't have the privilege of ignoring our laws and our Constitution.
So even after the insurrection, polls really have control of both the House and the Senate as potentially falling into the hands of Republicans, even after the previous president urged an insurrection. Do you have any criticism of your party? Do you think that the Democrats have been unable to message, and that has led to, frankly, a string of both political and judicial defeats, including the overturning of Roe versus Wade, the inability to pass voting reform, despite the fact that there is this very strong condemnation of Republicans at this time? Do Democrats have a problem here?
Well, I think sometimes the messaging is a problem. Obviously, Roe versus Wade, it wasn't the Congress that did away with it. It was a highly politicized Supreme Court. And whether one agrees or disagrees with their decision, I happen to disagree with it, the politicized way it was handled, Justice Alito and others, has damaged the Supreme Court and has damaged its credibility, and that's going to be bad for our country. If we do the same thing in the Congress, that's also going to be bad. The Senate has passed a lot of very good pieces of legislation, creating jobs, and a lot of good legislation in the environment and others, and we don't talk enough about it. We don't point out that the changes that have been made. And I feel we should be less reacting to whatever the latest charge was on the internet and talk about more about some of the things we've accomplished, which have been significant. I give one example. They say, what's the president doing? Well, look at Ukraine. And look at, for the first time in decades, how NATO came together to support a unified support against Russia and for Ukraine. Can you imagine them doing that with the last president who denigrated NATO, denigrated other countries, and showed a strong favoritism toward Russia, praising Putin, even as he committed war crimes? But Joe Biden, very quietly, off the radar, worked with each one of these foreign leaders and brought them in place. Not only did NATO show a greater unity than it has in years, but then countries like Finland said, we want to join NATO, and they're right on the border of Russia.
President Biden is a longtime Senate colleague of yours. How do you rate his presidency so far?
Well, I look at things like that. I look at the way he's come out of the recession he adopted. We've got one of the lowest unemployment rates we've had. We're coming around out of COVID. He's brought the world together on the threat we face, the existential threat we face from Russia. I rate that very high. I think the fact that he tries to get Republicans and Democrats back together, he gets criticized for that because it's often not successful. But yet that's what a president should do. Every president I've known in both parties, well, they'll have their own partisan interests, found times that they would try to bring Republicans and Democrats together for the good of the country.
So we have a comment from one of our listeners on Facebook. Brooks Harmon writes, many often complained about the so-called gerontocracy as illustrated by the demographics of the U.S. Congress and current and former presidents. I wonder how Senator Leahy would respond to those who complain about lifers in Congress. Why does he feel justified in not passing the torch? Why is it a good thing or a bad thing to have Congress people serve terms of significant length? What's your response?
Well, I am passing the torch, and all our polls showed that I would easily be reelected. But I said it's time for somebody else to come in there. I do point to the fact that Vermont had never really had as strong a voice as they've had with me in the Senate and as chairman of the Appropriations Committee and with the seniority. But I also remind everybody, if you don't like who's there, in the Senate we have elections every 6 years. In the House, we have it every 2 years. Certainly, I took advantage of that when I was 34 years old and ran. If people wanted change, then run for the office. And nobody owns their seat. And many do like I've done, even though I'm sure I'd be easily reelected this fall. I want somebody else to come in, because I want what's best for our state of Vermont and for the country.
So you mentioned the state of Vermont. Two of the most powerful members of the Senate come from a state that is very small. It has about the population of the city of Boston. What do you think about criticism that the Senate results in uneven distribution of power?
You know, the founders of the country did the right thing. They said every state has got to have their individual voice in the government, and they did that through the Senate. You know, California, when it became a state, had less people than the state of Vermont had at that time. Certainly nobody in Vermont objected to them coming in. Now, small states have sometimes, because of seniority, in the Senate have acquired some power, but that's because of the individuals they elect. But the Senate at least allows every state to have their own individuality in one branch, just one branch of the U.S. government.
So one, you're retiring from the Senate, but I have a question about one of your other professions. Senator, will you also be retiring from Batman movies?
Well, you know, I've loved being in the Batman movies. I had my first library card when I was 4 years old. I read everything, but I especially like reading Batman, and I ended up writing some things for Batman. I helped put together a Batman comic, which was very anti-landmine, and it actually influenced the Senate to pass unanimously the first law to ban the export of landmines. And the nice thing about it, being in the movies, I get to see how they photograph them and do them. They pay a lot of money, and I give every single cent of it to the Children's Library in Montpelier, Vermont, where I had my first library card when I was 4 years old. I enjoy doing that because I'm not a wealthy person, but this way I can give a lot of money.
So you're saying we may see you again. We look forward to that. So just finally, in the couple minutes we have left, what advice do you have for the younger generations of folks coming into the Senate, particularly at this crucial time in history when democracy is in peril?
I remind them that there's only 100 men and women to represent 325 million Americans. It's not about you. It's about the country. Are the things you're doing, is it for your own self-aggrandizement, or is it something that helps the country? If you're there simply for your own ego or your own political ambitions, you don't belong in the Senate. Be there to help the country.
Are you optimistic that the country can return to the sort of bipartisanship and respect for democracy that you write about in your memoir?
I go back and forth on that. I tend to be, I think, leaning more pessimistic, but by nature, I'm an optimistic person. I hope it can go. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book. It took a lot of time putting my notes together, but I wanted it not as, hey, look what Patrick Leahy did, but look at what the Senate was, what the Senate can be, and what the Senate should be. Because I think if the Senate returns and becomes the conscience of the nation, it could help our country. Because I think we face real peril in the United States right now with lack of respect for the laws and what we saw on January 6th.
Patrick Leahy is the Senate's senior most member and president pro tem and author of the new book, The Road Taken. Senator, thank you for spending the hour with us.
Kimberly, I enjoyed it. Thank you for your questions.
And I hope you have many wonderful days ahead of you back in the beautiful state of Vermont. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.